From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! ...53 years ago today, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. 8 years ago today, U.S. imposed sanctions were imposed on Iraq. Today, we'll talk to a delegation of U.S. citizens inspecting a nuclear weapons site in this country. Also, 50 years since the imposition of the draft, we'll talk to activists trying to halt military recruitment aimed at communities of color. And a conversation with a Native American leader about the Native American legacy around the issue of nuclear power. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On the 8th anniversary of the U.S.-led U.N. sanctions against Iraq, Iraq has broken off all cooperation with the United Nations weapons inspectors and is demanding the resignation of Chief Inspector Richard Butler. But Butler, who flew into New York for meetings with the U.N. Security Council, has ordered his team to continue their inspections. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan postponed a trip late last night to Portugal, where he was planning to meet with East Timorese leaders, so he could attend the Security Council meeting as well. Last night, Iraq delivered a statement to the United Nations asking that the disarmament panel UNSCOM be moved out of New York to free itself of U.S. influence and domination. Meanwhile, the hunger fast of members of the human rights group Voices in the Wilderness moves into its third week outside the United States mission to the United Nations. The group will commemorate the anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and the anniversary of the Iraqi sanctions with demonstrations at the U.N. There will also be demonstrations around the country today, including a citizens' inspection team that plans to investigate a U.S. sub-base in Groton, Connecticut, for violations of international law. We'll have more on that later in the show. Meanwhile, this news from New Delhi: thousands of people marched through the Indian capital today, chanting and carrying anti-nuclear placards to commemorate the anniversary of the world's first atomic bombing in Hiroshima. Nobel Peace Laureate and East Timorese resistance leader José Ramos Horta said today he will not take part in UN-sponsored talks between Indonesia and Portugal on autonomy for the Indonesian occupied territory. Horta said Indonesia must release all political prisoners, including East Timor rebel leader Xanana Gusmao, before talks can take place, and that Gusmao must be involved. Indonesia and Portugal yesterday agreed to talks on granting the country special status, that is East Timor, based on a wide-ranging autonomy. Timorese have said they will accept autonomy if it will lead to self-determination. The Indonesian government has proposed autonomy as a way to maintain control. This news from the Congo: artillery and small weapons fire were reported today in two cities in eastern Congo, where President Laurent Kabila is facing a rebellion by former allies in the province where he began his revolution. Kabila's embattled government said the fighting was being orchestrated by neighboring Rwanda's Tutsi-led government, which helped bring him to power. But a leader of the mutineers went on the air on a captured rebel radio station to deny the accusation. The station said the rebels had captured the two largest cities in the eastern Kivu province and were attacking government-held positions elsewhere. A defense ministry official insisted government troops were not threatened. Union ground workers at Northwest Airlines and Eagan, Minnesota, have overwhelmingly authorized a strike after rejecting the company's tentative contract agreements. The vote means a federal mediator will now step in to mediate talks between Northwest and the International Association of Machinists. The IAM represents aircraft mechanics, baggage handlers, office workers, and security personnel. Northwest already has big labor troubles with its pilots. An impasse in negotiations with the Airline Pilots Association was declared last week. Pilots could strike as early as August 29th. Both unions are demanding higher pay and better work rules. The Boston Globe yesterday asked columnist Mike Barnicle to resign because he lifted jokes from comedian George Carlin for one of his columns without attribution. Barnicle told a television station he wouldn't resign. The Barnicle controversy comes less than 2 months after columnist Patricia Smith resigned from the paper after it was disclosed she'd fabricated sources and quotes in her columns. Several days after Smith's resignation, the Globe reported it had reviewed 364 Barnicle columns dating to January 96. The Globe concluded that those columns met professional standards. The House committee investigating campaign fundraising could turn up the heat on Attorney General Janet Reno today. The Republican-run panel is threatening to cite Reno for contempt of Congress. Reno has refused to give the panel two memos in which her top advisors recommend she call for an independent counsel to investigate Democratic fundraising. Reno says the memos should not be made public. In her words, no attorney general has turned over documents like this under such circumstances. But the committee's Republican chair, Dan Burton, says Reno must obey the congressional subpoenas. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And I see that over on Wall Street, they're still a little nervous. They will be this, or they should be this morning, with the ups and downs of the stock market of late.
That's right. I see Wall Street has gone down. I notice I have to take a bigger step when I come into our new office here at 120 Wall Street as it slowly recedes there. But there is some interesting news going on around the world. In the news headlines, I just read about these talks that are taking place at the United Nations between Indonesia and Portugal around the status of East Timor. And this is an interesting news construction. Looking at the New York Times today, it really is a perfect example of the way the mainstream media can work to, I don't know if we want to say fabricate a story, but certainly just give you one side. There's a big piece in the New York Times that says Indonesia agrees to an autonomy plan for East Timor. It's by Barbara Crissett. It's from the United Nations yesterday after the talks between Portugal and Indonesia, which were, by the way, moderated by Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General. So that is significant. They held a news conference, but you only really see the quotes of the foreign minister of Indonesia in this piece. And it's a large piece, which is first highlighted on the front page, and you turn to page 3 for the article. There's a picture, though, of José Ramos Horta, who is the Nobel Peace Laureate from East Timor. It says, Ramos Horta, the Nobel Peace Laureate, reacting to news that Portugal and Indonesia had reached agreement on East Timor. And it has a picture, a big picture, of him smiling. Well, it doesn't quote him. It doesn't quote any East Timorese in the piece, despite the fact that at the news conference yesterday stood the Indonesians, the Portuguese, which the UN still considers the administering power of East Timor, and the Timorese. Timorese angry because they are not included in these talks. But Barbara Crissett decided to, I guess, maintain the line of Indonesia and only quote the Indonesians.
Amy, do you mean that they have a photo of Ramos Horta reacting, but they don't mention what the reaction is?
That's right. Well, it says that he's very happy, and it shows a picture of him smiling. Yet here we have a piece from Reuters that I read in the news headlines saying Ramos Horta says he will not participate in the talks until all Timorese political prisoners are released, in particular Xanana Gusmão, who is the rebel leader of East Timor. So that's what we have to get outside of the New York Times. If you just look at the New York Times, you see that Indonesia has agreed to an autonomy plan, and I just want to emphasize that the Timorese have said that they will accept autonomy if it leads to a referendum, if it leads to an act of self-determination. At this point, the Indonesians have continued to refuse to discuss a referendum on self-determination. The Indonesian government has proposed autonomy as their way to keep control. And just a few weeks ago in East Timor, a Timorese man who held up a sign that said, "Autonomy equals integration." Integration is the Indonesian term for annexation of East Timor. A Timorese man who held up that sign, "Autonomy equals integration," was blown away by Indonesian soldiers. He was shot dead in front of some European ambassadors. So it's very important to decode the news we get from places like the New York Times that, I might add, continues to use when reporting from East Timor the dateline Dili, Indonesia, Now, the United Nations has not accepted the integration of Dili, the capital of East Timor, or East Timor overall, has not accepted that Dili is a part of Indonesia, says it's a part of East Timor, but the New York Times refers to it as Dili, the capital of East Timor in Indonesia.
And I haven't seen much reference to the report of the 500 bodies supposedly found in mass graves in another part of Indonesia that came out yesterday. It doesn't seem to have gotten much attention.
That's right. And these are the kinds of stories that we will continue, as well as the missing activists taken by COPASIS troops over the last year. COPASIS troops trained by U.S. soldiers, U.S. Green Berets. Well, Juan, you had an interesting piece in the New York Daily News yesterday that comes out of the Capitol shooting of a few weeks ago. You had a good piece about a man in New York also afraid of leaving a hospital. It's about mental illness. And the Wall Street Journal also had an interesting piece called Why Deinstitutionalization Turned Deadly. This all following the Weston shooting.
Yeah, well, basically, I wrote about Peter Fazio, who about 10 days ago, he was hospitalized at Manhattan Psychiatric Hospital, one of the state-owned hospitals in New York City, and had been told that he was going to be let out after 15 years of being in this hospital, and did not want to leave, and ended up committing suicide in the hospital. And there was almost no press attention about his death. But basically, it highlights the fact that in New York State, Governor Pataki, like across the nation, political leaders continue to empty out mental institutions without providing any sort of real follow-up or transition period for people who are being deinstitutionalized. And it's from the 1950s, we've dropped the population of mental institutions about 90% throughout the country. And many of the crimes that are now being committed, violent crimes, unfortunately, are being committed by mentally ill people who were not giving the proper follow-up or medication or community-based treatment once they were deinstitutionalized. And there have been numerous instances over the last few years of people who are committing horrendous crimes, including the one in the Capitol, where basically you had sick people who had not gotten the proper treatment in this continued stampede to deinstitutionalize without follow-up.
That's right. And the man that you wrote about, Peter Fazio, who killed himself, had threatened to kill himself if he was released. He was very afraid. He was a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. And in the Wall Street Journal piece, they talk about the numbers of people in this country who have symptoms of schizophrenia or manic depression, some 3.5 million. The National Advisory Mental Health Council has estimated that 40% of them, roughly 1.4 million people, are not receiving any treatment in any given year. And it's an interesting way to look at this whole case of Russell Weston, the drifter with schizophrenia, who is allegedly murdered the two policemen, J.J. Chestnut and John Gibson, in his assault on the Capitol. Very important to remember that. Well, today is the 53rd anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima, the first time an atomic bomb was dropped on a population. It's also the 8th anniversary of the U.S.-led U.N. sanctions against Iraq. And commemorating these two anniversaries today, a coalition of anti-nuclear groups calling themselves the New England Citizens Weapons Inspection Team will investigate the status of nuclear-armed submarines at the U.S. Navy submarine base in Groton, Connecticut. They're attempting to carry out a weapons inspection that mirrors the UNSCOM weapons inspections in Iraq. They're particularly concerned about the capabilities of the Seawolf and attack submarine stationed at the base, and say the U.S. may be violating the very international laws it accuses Iraq of violating. As we speak, they're interviewing personnel at the base, and earlier this week, the group flew a plane over the base and took aerial photographs of Seawolf submarines. The efforts of the coalition have been spearheaded by the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and we're joined now by two of its members, Clayton Ramey, Disarmament Program Coordinator of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and John Deere, its Executive Director. Clayton Ramey, let's begin with you. Can you tell us well, more clearly, why you are in Groton, Connecticut today.
Good morning to you and all your listeners. Thank you very much. We're in Groton, Connecticut to continue the work of the Citizens Inspection Team to bring light to the condition of nuclear weapons armaments in the United States, and to also assert the right of independent citizens, in this case U.S. citizens, but on Monday, U.S., Canadian, and New Zealand citizens, to intervene in the inspection of facilities that either manufacture nuclear weapons or manufacture delivery systems for nuclear weapons. Essentially, the idea of the Citizens Weapons Inspection began earlier this year when a group of Canadian and U.S. citizens in Bangor, Washington, inspected a naval base to determine whether or not that base, in fact, was in violation of certain international treaty provisions, points of the Nuremberg Convention, and lastly, points of the International Court of Justice decision that essentially says that the threatened use or actual use of nuclear weapons is in fact contrary to international law. So we're here as taxpayers who pay into this monstrous system of nuclear weapons production and as people of conscience to make sure that our nation knows the extent to which these treaties are being violated and that nuclear weapons are still being manufactured and deployed around the United States and around the world.
Well, Clayton Ramey, what kind of cooperation have you gotten from government officials on your inspection?
Very little, actually. We went to the gates of the electric boat shipyard in Groton, Connecticut on Monday, armed with nothing more than the moral law that says thou shalt not kill, which, of course, is the law that we follow.
And was this a surprise visit?
No, it wasn't a surprise visit. We contacted the president of E-Boat at Groton more than a month before the visit. We reiterated our desire to have a meeting with him to carry out our responsibility for the inspection process several times during the month between mid-July and August 3rd. And then we came, and we were there. They, of course, stood at the gate essentially and said that it was a secure defense facility and that we had no right to go there. And we essentially said we do have a right to go there. And we did suspect that the shipyard maintained the capacity to continue the manufacturing of Trident submarines, which are the most deadly and obscene engines of mass destruction ever manufactured by humankind. So we were barred from entering, but we did make our point, and we did, in fact, get significant press and news coverage. And more than that, we were able to fly over the base a little while later to determine that the facilities that manufacture these submarines are still intact.
When you say you were able to fly over the base, can you talk a little more about that flight? I mean, that's quite a picture here with all that's going on around Iraq. You have this peace group that is now inspecting a U.S. weapons site. Who was in the plane?
A videographer and Libby Davies, who was a member of parliament representing Vancouver East in the Canadian parliament, and a New England anti-nuclear activists were in the plane along with the pilot, and the purpose of the overflight, as you mentioned, was just to be able to visually confirm the fact that the sub-base, the electric boat shipyard, and they're really downriver from each other, about a mile or so separates them, are both in the business of manufacturing the instruments by which nuclear weapons are launched. So the overflight was only about 10 minutes, but what we did was record and document the fact that while the United States is inspecting Iraq and while the UNSCOM process is sort of looking into classrooms and other kinds of storage facilities and private homes even in Iraq to attempt to manufacture the idea that Iraq may have the components for weapons of mass destruction, that we have real evidence, solid photographic visual evidence of those things existing right here in the United States. And that was the purpose of the flyover.
We're going to go to John Deere in just a minute, the executive director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, to find out exactly what your plans are for today. And then we're going to turn to another group on this 53rd anniversary of the dropping of the bomb in Hiroshima and find out how they're dealing with military recruiting in schools, particularly in urban areas. Finally, we're going to talk with a Native American leader of the Indigenous Environmental Network about the nuclear legacy as it relates to Native Americans. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and on this 53rd anniversary of the dropping of the nuclear bomb on Hiroshima, we bring you this special. Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez as we finish up our conversation on what's happening today in Groton, Connecticut, a peace group, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, inspecting the weapons site there. Our guests, Clayton Ramey and John Deere, both of that group. John Deere, you're FOR's executive director. What exactly are you doing today?
Well, good morning, Amy. As you heard, we're gathered here in Groton, Connecticut, preparing in a short while to have a press conference and then begin a demonstration. And then the Citizens Weapons Inspection Team is going to try to enter the base there, the U.S. Navy submarine base. So basically, as Clayton was saying, we're trying to, officially gather evidence about how the United States is breaking international law by allowing and threatening to use these weapons, by allowing them to exist. And then, to interview people, procure documentation, photograph the site, to continue to do that. And then, to announce our findings. But as you can imagine, Amy, we're not going to get very far. So I suspect that we'll be stopped right at the entrance and that perhaps 10 to 25 people from the group will be arrested. So there'll be probably 100 to 150 of us going up right to the entrance to the U.S. Sub-base and trying to investigate and to expose the hypocrisy of what the U.S. is doing here and what it's forcing Iraq to do and to get some truth announced to the world.
And John Deere, are there activities anywhere else around the country on this anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing?
Well, it's such a day, We remember 130,000 people incinerated in Hiroshima 53 years ago, and we remember 8 years ago today the U.S. Enforcing the sanctions. So right now there are people gathering at the Pentagon in D.C. who are speaking out against nuclear weapons and the Iraqi sanctions. There are people preparing to demonstrate outside and even inside nonviolently at the United Nations. I think there are people gathering this morning at Livermore Labs in California and even at the Nevada test site. So those are the events that I know that are going on. And people are trying to keep the memory alive and to continue to speak out and to, keep some hope going in the peace and justice movement. And to keep saying, enough is enough, these weapons shouldn't exist, the sanctions have to stop, the killing's got to stop, and trying to wake people up from the obsession, with, let's say, Monica Lewinsky and point out the real crimes that are going on in this country, which are these weapons, I think.
Well, John Deere, I want to thank you very much for joining us. If people want to get in touch with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, where can they call?
Great. Well, FOR is located in Nyack, New York. We're at P.O. Box 271, Nyack, New York, 10960, and our phone number is 914-358-4601.
One more time, the phone number?
Yeah, that's 914-358-4601.
Thank you very much, both John Deere and Clayton Ramey of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. A creative protest today as this peace group inspects the U.S. Navy submarine base in Groton, Connecticut. Well, the devastation of Hiroshima and the continuing sanctions against Iraq, what some activists call an ongoing economic war, are only two examples of the terrible toll exacted by the U.S. military on foreign soil. But if there's one place where there's more likelihood of encountering a U.S. military presence than the streets of a developing country, it would be in the impoverished communities of color right here in the United States. The military is conducting a $1.9 billion campaign through media advertising and school recruitment to convince young people of color that the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines are the best options for a successful future. We're joined right now by two people who are involved in an anti-recruiting effort. Mario Hardy is a staff member with the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors and coordinator of Military Out of Our Schools program. Also, we're joined by Toy Wen, who is with Asian Americans United, a Philadelphia community-based advocacy group for Asian Americans. Let's begin with Mario Hardy. Tell us about your program to counter recruiting in the schools. How much of it is going on today?
In terms of actual recruiting, within our public schools, we can go into any public school in any inner city right now and find a junior ROTC program, find military recruiters who are on site day in, day out in these schools. Part of my work is interacting with recruiters and finding out trends in recruiting and keeping up with these things. Now, one of the things to really concentrate on where we really notice the trend is that if I go into a school in the inner city in New York or in Philadelphia or Detroit or Los Angeles, you'll find Be All You Can Be, Aim High, The Few, The Proud, The Marines. These posters will be everywhere. You'll see a number of people in uniform on a daily basis pulling young people to the side, doing what they call mentoring and so forth. Now, if you go to a more affluent area, suburban areas, schools that are more well-funded, attended by people who are of a higher economic class, so to speak, you will find virtually none of this. From time to time, you will find a military recruiter in these schools, and when asked what they're doing at those schools, they'll tell you very distinctly that they're looking for officers. Within the inner cities, and particularly within communities of color, they're not looking for officers. They're not looking for young people to offer college scholarships to. They're not looking for young people to offer college money for. What they're looking for, in fact, is grunts, as they say, or frontline soldiers, people to be recruited into the lowest ranks of the military and to be recruited into the military's dead-end jobs.
Well, Mario Hardy, what about those ads that we see on television all the time about the military and the promise of better pay and better education through the military? What are the facts in terms of what the average youth, especially from a third world community, can look forward to if they go through the military?
Right now, what's being advertised is $40,000 for college. That's under the Montgomery GI Bill. The Montgomery GI Bill is not to be confused with the post-World War II era GI Bill. That GI Bill did what it said. It bought people houses. It sent people to college. What this GI Bill is something completely different. The way that it's advertised, particularly to young people of color, about 500,000 of them a year, is they're told that that money is as good as in the bank. All you have to do is sign the dotted line. The thing that they quickly find out is less than 0.5% of these 500,000 kids who sign up for that money get $40,000. In order to get that amount of money, you have to qualify for something called the Army-Navy Scholarship Fund. If you can qualify for the Army-Navy Scholarship Fund, you wouldn't have to be going into the military to get money for college. You'd be kicking down the door at Princeton yourself. At that point, the most money you can get is $16,000. That's for 4 years of college. 70% of these half a million kids a year who get any of this money, what they do is the numbers show that 70% go to either a two-year junior college or to a community college. Now, they don't tell you up front that $1,200 of this money is your own money. In effect, it costs $1,200 for poor people to join the military these days, but they don't tell you that. I'll give you an example. If you end up going to a two-year community college for your associate's degree through the GI Bill, say it costs $4,000 on the high end. You take away $1,200. Well, you just joined the military for 8 years. The military is an eight-year commitment now. It can be broke down into 4 years active, 4 years reserve, or 3 and 5, 2 and 6. They'll work with you. But the reality is you've now traded 8 years of your life for $2,800 in financial aid. It should be pointed out that the average monetary award for people going to college, and these are particularly poor people from inner cities who enlist, is about $6,800. So in exchange for 4 years of active duty, you're only getting $6,800 worth of financial aid on the average. If you get a need-based Pell Grant, which is need-based financial aid, which everyone qualifies for as long as you're poor, you could get up to $16,000. So it's actually very misleading when they tell people $40,000 for college.
But what about all that great training you're supposed to get in the military, that fantastic training that prepares you for all those high-tech skills when you get out?
Well, the fact of the matter is, for enlisted people, you see, you're not going to be flying airplanes or helicopters if you're enlisted. That's what the officers do. You're not going to be working in these great high-tech fields for the most part, you know, for the most part, if you're enlisted. The fact of the matter is military training is for military jobs. You know, basically, the computer, I remember in the 80s, the early 80s, one of the big things was computer training. Join the military, learn computers. Computers are the wave of the future. And they didn't bother to tell anyone that the computer training that you get in the military and the systems that are used in the military are completely inapplicable to civilian life. Again, on the other hand, someone, instead of trading in 8 years of your life, and also let's not forget the abuse, the discrimination, the hazing and so forth, the sexual assault and abuse and racism that exists in the military, not to trade in all of those, your freedom and all those things and risk all those things. We have computer learning centers right here in our communities where they offer job training and job placement and 6 to 8 week courses. And what happens is someone who goes into the military, after they get out of active duty in 4 or 6 years, they have to come and get in line behind those people who've been trained and have job placement. These people have been trained on relevant computer systems, not computer systems that are obsolete in the civilian sector. One example, I counseled a Native American young person a couple years ago who he joined the military because he wanted to get off the reservation, number one, and number two, he wanted to learn how to drive tractor trailers. He found out the hard way that a military truck driver's license doesn't apply in the civilian sector. And after getting out of the military, suffering a lot of abuses, he had to get in line behind people who went to 8 week tractor trailer courses, and he had to reapply for his license. And basically he just found himself 4 years behind everyone else. And that does seem to be the trend.
We're talking to Mario Hardy, who is a staff person with the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors, which is actually celebrating its 50th anniversary, also coordinator of the Military Out of Our Schools program. Also on the line, Toy Nguyen with Asian Americans United. Toy Nguyen, you also go into the schools. What kids understand is the opportunity in the military, now that we understand what the opportunities actually are?
Oh, my program is actually not counter recruitment. Although I'm affiliated with Asian Americans United, I am actually a staff member of the American Friends Service Committee Youth Leadership and Action Program. I don't actually do counter recruitment within the school. What I have observed, though, is the same kinds of recruitment efforts by the military within, you know, young communities of color is also present within the Asian American community. More insidiously, I think, is because the public doesn't actually hear about it so much because it's such a small community. And within the larger Asian American community, you're going to have mostly the Southeast Asian community that is affected, young people, young men, young women, because, as you know, the bipolarity within the Asian American community, where you have more of the East and Northeast Asian community who have been here in the United States for several generations, are not generally as vulnerable to the kinds of misinformation and disinformation about the military as would a Cambodian youth, a Vietnamese youth, a Laotian youth, and particularly Filipino young men and women.
But in the Asian community in general, especially among the older generation, certainly there is a knowledge about the American military because of the huge installations that the United States has in many Asian countries. Is there sort of a gap between what the youth understand and what their parents might understand?
That's a bit of an irony, actually. I think that growing up within an Asian, Southeast Asian community, while, you know, our families were very fresh from the war experience of Vietnam and Southeast Asia in general, I think that, you know, as you pointed out earlier, 1.9 billion campaign to glorify violence and military reinforces the idea that military or armed confrontation is the answer. And as you know, most of the Southeast Asian community in the United States were actually were brought here because of their alliance with the United States during those wars. So those who were opposed to U.S. intervention in their country were either not brought here or brought here in very few numbers, small numbers. So what you have is you have family life and you know, parents who, although they have a fresh memory of the war, they are actually sometimes very proud when their sons or daughters join the military, mainly because there's not enough opportunities for their children available for them, such as, you know, a college education or a job fresh out of high school. Most young men find themselves unemployed, very frustrated if their grades are not good enough for a college education. So what it turns out to be is that the parents are very proud of the fact that they've made something of themselves, that they buy into the whole self-discipline and goodness that the military can train you to be, a good person that the military can train you to be.
Well, I'd like to ask Clayton Ramey for a second. I'm sorry.
Mario Hardy.
Mario, I'm sorry. Yes, I'd like to ask you what in terms of the population of the military. I know those of us who are a little up in years remember the days of the draft when all the people who are now in political office, like Gingrich and Clinton and the others, managed to escape it. But since the military became volunteer or professional, what's the percentage now of people of color that are in the military? Is it growing? Is it diminishing? And what is the image in generally in communities of color about the military?
At this point right now, see, the thing is, there's been a steady increase in the number of particularly African Americans and overall in general people of color within the military. Within the Latino community, there's some ups and some downs. But on the overall, there's more of an upward trend always in terms of recruiting within communities of color. One example is in the early part of this decade, If we look back, we remember Operation Desert Storm. And if we also remember the L.A. uprising in the aftermath of the Rodney King beating, these two events were cited by the military to be two events that caused the first downward trend in terms of African-American enlistment in the military. Number one, the Gulf War was not a very popular war within communities of color, mainly because it was a reinforcement of U.S. foreign policy and how U.S. foreign policy deals with people of color as opposed to how U.S. foreign policy deals with people who look like they do. We can see the differences in Haiti, Somalia, and Iraq, but then we go to Bosnia and some of these countries and we look and see how they're handled much differently. This was something within the African-American community that, and within communities of color in general, that people, again, said, you know, here's another example of how that happens. The other thing was the military said that it was an overall disregard for authority and just a diminished, just kind of a black eye on the face of America after the L.A. uprising. And they noticed that at that point, for the first time in over a decade, that there was a very slight drop in the amount of African-Americans enlisting in the military. So at that point, what they decided to do, headed by General Colin Powell, was to expand the number of junior ROTC units, which are high school ROTC units, across the country from about 1,400 units to about 3,500 units over a two-year period. The reason that they said they did this was to create favorable attitudes towards the military and careers in military service. And if you look at where these units were put, for the most part, they were in very poor, economically challenged areas with high concentrations of people of color.
And when you say where they're put, you mean they're actually the junior ROTC units are put in the schools? What do you mean by units?
What it is, it's actually when you get junior ROTC in your school, you get more than a textbook and, you know, a couple notebooks and a lesson plan. What you get is you get two military instructors. You get two retired military individuals whose salaries are paid by the military and are also paid by the school district. These people are not certified teachers. What they are is they're military folks, and they're brought in. You also bring in drill supplies. In some cases, that includes firearms. There's actually junior ROTC programs that have firearms training, and they're called marksmanship programs. So at the same time where we're working to get weapons out of our inner-city schools, here you have the U.S. military bringing weapons into the schools and having them fired on campus. There's been instances of violence associated with this as well.
Mario Hardy, I'm sorry, but we are going to have to break at this point. I do want to thank you very much for joining us. Mario Hardy, staff member with the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors. Interesting note to end on about bringing weapons into the schools and coordinator of the military out of our schools program. And Toy Nguyen with Asian Americans United and the American Friends Service Committee in Philadelphia. The phone number for military out of our schools
is 215-563-8787 or toll-free nationwide 1-888-236-2226. That's 236-CCCO.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And coming up next, the ending of the Native American gathering that just finished up in Northern California, Protecting Mother Earth gathering. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! To cap off our program today on this 53rd anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, we turn to a group that may not first come to mind when talking about the nuclear age, Native Americans. Today in Northern California, a five-day conference of the Indigenous Environmental Network is wrapping up. Some 1,500 people gathered to talk about topics ranging from their struggle against the Nevada nuclear test site, which sits on sacred land, to the controversial nuclear waste depository at Yucca Mountain. Tom Goldtooth is the National Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Tom, first tell us a little about yourself, how you got involved with IEN, and what is happening in California at this meeting.
Well, I live up in Minnesota, and we're dealing with a lot of issues up in Minnesota that range from protection of our water. There's mercury contamination up in the Great Lakes there, and that mercury is coming in from various industries, from the incinerators, the whole hierarchy of solid waste disposal up in that area has created incineration. Incineration is one of the main contributors of mercury pollution. A lot of these pollutants are persistent, and they accumulate in our food web. So there are fish advisories up in that area where there's high levels of mercury contamination in the fish tissue. And our people, a lot of people up there, the Anishinaabe, the Dakota Sioux, and other tribes that live in the whole chain of Great Lakes, not only just Minnesota, consume fish. It's a subsistence, and we are land-based cultures. So there's a lot of populations up there that still go out and trap and fish and eat wild rice and wild game and berries. And so there's concern about the future of our people with mercury contamination, as well as other issues and toxins like dioxin. You know, a couple years ago, in the early 1980s, the government was looking for a repository for nuclear waste, and they did explore various tribal areas in Minnesota. Every tribe and its community said no way. There was resistance of even these companies from coming in and drilling to see if the geology and the rock formations were adequate for storing nuclear waste. So toxic waste has been an issue up there, deforestation, clear cutting, impact to our habitat, so those are some of the issues we deal with, I got involved, with this because it's really connected to our spirituality. I'm concerned about my children in our future generation. And, I've worked Indian Affairs, I've worked, the environment is closely related to our traditions and things that we do. And so it's just something that I got very passionate about and felt that I needed to do something. I needed to get involved with this.
Which tribe are you a part of?
I am enrolled in the Navajo Nation down in the Southwest, and also I'm affiliated with the Dakota Sioux Nation up in Minnesota.
I understand that the whole issue of anti-nuclear activism is one that is being discussed extensively at the conference. In addition to Minnesota, where else are the major anti-nuclear battles taking place between Indigenous peoples and corporations and the government?
Well, I think the audience needs to know that the battles is throughout Turtle Island. The battles is throughout the Western Hemisphere, as well as other areas throughout the world. It is an issue of industrialization and globalization and its impact on all people. It appears at a disproportionate level when we start looking at subsistence cultures such as Indigenous peoples and rural as well as rural populations. Indigenous peoples, we're closely connected to the land. We are the land, and the land is us. So, it seems like what we're witnessing here in the past 4 days is testimony from our people saying that we don't want to be the miner's canary anymore. That we know that we are impacted health-wise as well as our environment from industrialization, and that we're concerned that these policies, these federal policies that industrialized countries have developed to supposedly protect the environment, do not adequately protect subsistence cultures, and we need to do something about that. We need to address that. So the irony of this is that now, 500 years later, after colonization of this country, people are looking to the native people for some direction, to start trying to look at what values and what philosophies we go by that may help and change things as far as international and national policies that will protect our planet. I mean, these are things that we're very concerned about. You know, some of the issues throughout, you know, that we're dealing with here is that, you know, right now as we sit here, is that the government as well as the nuclear industry is trying to develop a nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste dump at Yucca Mountain in Nevada against the wishes and of the Western Shoshone people. At Utah, the Skull Valley Goshutes, who are Paiutes, they are opposed to the development of a nuclear waste dump in their homeland. Further down the Colorado River, along the Arizona and California border, the Fort Mojave, the Chimaweve, the Quechan, the Kokopa, and the Colorado River Indian tribes are all opposing the construction of a low-level radioactive waste dump that's located near their lands on Bureau of Land Management land, federal land. They're telling the federal government of the United States, this is sacred land to us, and you have a government-to-government relationship to us. We don't want it there. But despite that, you know, they've had to continue battling the policies that do not protect it, that do not recognize the value of that site as a sacred area, as a holy area. These are just some examples. We can go into the Great Lakes, where the Mohawk people along the St. Lawrence River corridor already have high levels of PCB in their system. As well, you know, we look at the women where there have been studies, there are PCB contamination in their breast milk. This has been a result of General Motors and Reynolds Aluminum plants that were sited along the area that have contaminated their waterway and their land. And there is a Superfund site there. And they've been involved, the tribe there, the Mohawks, have been involved with the remediation and cleanup of that site. But there's been foot dragging there by EPA, feeling EPA has been heavily lobbied by the industry, General Motors, to not adequately clean up the area. They're arguing over the thresholds, levels of thresholds, how clean is clean. You know, again, I think our Native people are trying to push a higher standard of cleanup, a higher standard of living, and be more ethical when we talk about, as U.S. citizens and tribal citizens, about environmental protection.
Today is the 53rd anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima,
right,
on August 6th, 1945, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this day in this country as you deal with these Native American anti-nuclear struggles around, as you call it, Turtle Island.
Well, I'm very emotional about it. You know, right now as we're speaking, there, you know, we have people leaving. Okay. You know, on the last day of the conference, there was a plenary on nuclear colonialism. We had people from Nevada. We had people from Utah. People who their grandparents witnessed the testing that took place, the bombing and testing that took place in Nevada, which they say was the most bombed, you know, area in the world, consistently throughout the years. And a lot of them testified that their relatives died of cancer, respiratory illnesses, and other unknown illnesses. And a lot of them were very emotional about that. You know, so yes, you know, it's something that we're very concerned about this. Along the Columbia River, the whole weapons production industry ships their nuclear waste along the Columbia River up to Hanford. There are subsistence cultures along that still. These are the river people. They are picking up fish tissue that are contaminated. They fall off the bones. So we're hearing these things, and so it's very emotional to our indigenous peoples here in the United States as well as Canada when we talk about these issues related to nuclear development.
Does Washington, what goes on in Congress, have any significance to you?
It does in one way, is that this country and our ancestors negotiated treaties. We have agreements that many of them have been broken. And we try to teach our future generation that they need, you know, to continue to fight to make this country accountable for the treaties that it negotiated with our people. This is Aboriginal land. A lot of us do feel that this is still occupied country. We are the older brothers and sisters of this continent. All other immigrants are younger sisters. So Washington does have significance because they have a trust responsibility. We have a treaty with them, and they need to recognize that. When it comes to environmental protection, is that they have to start implementing environmental laws and that include our native input. Okay, so we're starting to work on that. It's been only a couple of years, but we see some changes taking place.
Now that the Indigenous Environmental Network Mother Earth Gathering is over, where do you go from here? And if people want to get involved in some way, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, we have a national office in Bemidji, Minnesota. We're only about 35 miles from the headwaters of the Mississippi River. Our number is area code 218-751-4967. We do have a web page that's HTTP. Well, it's www.alphaacdc.com/IEN. That's where people can get more information about our network. We're going to take this information that we gathered here, you know, take it back with us, and we have some commitments of some of the workshops and breakout sessions that focus on various issues to do follow-up. You know, we're an advocacy group. We provide information and referral to people looking for information and support. We do some training and community organizing, we put out a publication. So we will take a lot of this information and disseminate it. Definitely, we will continue to struggle within this maze of federalism, both on Canada's side as well as U.S., to get them to be more responsive and to the environmental needs of our people. You know, this is an environmental justice issue, definitely, that we've been working on for the past couple of years.
Well, Tom Goldtooth, I want to thank you very much for joining us, National Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network of Minnesota, just wrapping up the conference of IEN that took place throughout the week near Mount Shasta in Northern California. Thanks very much for being with us.
Okay.
And that does it for today's edition of Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Hsu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland, our technical director, Julie Drizin. Our executive producer, our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!